In previous episodes of this conversation,
there was nothing in Skinner's verbal behavior that could be salvaged, as far as I could tell. If you took the terms he used literally, it just didn't make any sense.
I suspect that you and he would probably have agreed on certain political things about totalitarian control versus other kinds of control. And
You're talking now about the review of Beyond Freedom and Dignity?
Yes, yes.
Well, I thought that book was pure totalitarianism. It was about how to control and manipulate people by some master controller who somehow knew all the answers. But in the 50s, in Cambridge, where I was, Skinner was just orthodoxy. Everybody worshiped at his feet. Skinner and I personally remained perfectly friendly. We understood each other perfectly. We understood that we cannot discuss these topics. They're fixed. He knew the answers. Doesn't matter what the facts are. So we talked about other things.
Again, it satisfies me because it's a way of bringing these things in which people have been opposed to each other and showing that we can have a common way of thinking and talking about them. I somehow feel that should we keep on going? Or I somehow feel there are so many questions we could still talk about.
Can we reschedule to continue sometime?
Okay, so welcome both of you back to another third episode. We're very glad to have you again here. You'll recognize me from last time. My hair is a little bit longer, and this has also become, it has almost become like a Christmas tradition, like a Christmas gathering or something. So I'll be very, very brief. What I'll do is I briefly summarize some of the topics you went through. It won't be in a lot of detail, just to give the tone, and then I'll give you the microphone and you can continue talking about whatever you want. As we talked previous to the starting of the episode, you'll have a couple of minutes at the end to sort of close your positions or your views on language, as you might say. Last time you talked about compatibilities and incompatibilities between both of your views on the study on language, like how the issue of language gets approached by both. One might be paying attention first to the environment and the other to the current structure. He also talked about a very important issue, which is that of multiple causation. That is that language is a process influenced by a lot of variables, both immediate and distant, and coming from different levels of analysis, perhaps. And related to these, you also briefly discussed this, the extent to which language has principles or laws from which it can be perhaps predicted. You also talked about the views of Skinner about society and behavior control, and sort of some issues with that position, perhaps. You also shortly talked about what we mean when we say choice or freedom, how these terms are interrelated and how they can be approached from a scientific point of view. Also in the talking about language. Also you talk about Skinnerian views of language and its research and the extent of the impact of these ideas in academia, and also some controversies and misunderstandings that could be related to them. You also talked about how common vocabulary about the environment and the self emerges in the context of language, how individual experience, behavior, and meaning relate to each other. You talked about existence of or not of internal a priori structures, be it conceptual or sort of pre-conceptual in perception and language. Also about the richness of language and thought related to the apparent poorness of stimulation in early years. And this is the point on which we finished on sort of abruptly. So if you feel like it, you can go on from this point or open a new front, as you would say, if that pleases you. So now the floor is yours.
Well, would you like to begin now or shall I?
Why don't you begin?
Okay. I guess the several themes that keep coming up, which I wouldn't mind exploring a little. I had the impression in our talk about evolution that there are all these different varieties of ways of talking about evolution. There was originally Darwinian work, but Darwin didn't had only Mendelian genetics to go on, if that. And so by the end of the 19th century, people were saying Darwinism was dead. And the dominant kinds of things that arose then were orthogenesis and Lamarckism and these other alternatives. And it wasn't until the 20s when the geneticists started studying mutations that the source of variation became available that made Darwin's position more tenable. I get the impression from the ways in which you were talking about selection that in some ways your thinking is a bit more like an orthogenesis than a selectionist, because when we talked about it, selection you thought about as coming later, but the structures limited the kinds of variations. Could you comment on that?
Sure. So let's take a look at contemporary evolutionary theory, which does revise, of course, it's based on Darwin, but revises it in a number of ways. Darwin had assumed that, in fact, said strongly that all evolutionary changes must be very small. And he has some statement in which he says, if this doesn't prove to be the case, my whole theory collapses. Well, that was an unfortunate statement, because it isn't the case, but his whole theory doesn't collapse. We now know that there can be, it's been recognized and understood in the last 30 or 40 years, that there can be small, very small changes that can lead to broad effects. And it's completely compatible with evolutionary theories. There's nothing about natural selection. If you look at the nature of evolution broadly, abstractly, you can think of it in happening in three stages. You have a system, say a bacterium, and some random change takes place. Maybe a mutation, maybe gene transfer, maybe a genetic drift, maybe one organism, microorganism, accidentally swallows another. Lots of changes take place. The last one that I mentioned seems to have been a very significant one in evolutionary history. It's the step that broke the bacterial, the structure of microorganisms, and led to the development of complex multicellular creatures, eukaryotic cells. One accidental step suddenly led to a new system. That happened again with mitochondria, according to Walter Gehring's theory. Pretty much the same thing happened with vision. Accidentally, a particular molecule entered in, an opsin molecule entered into a cell, laid the basis for transferring light to electrical energy. You got all visual systems and so on. So you can have small accidents which have big effects. That's not a surprise anymore. In that respect, Darwin's theory had to be expanded. So the first step in evolution is just some change, maybe accidental. Often maybe a cosmic ray comes by and mutations take place, anything. That's the first stage. Second stage is that nature has to look at this new system and determine how to structure it. Well, we assume here normal science. What nature looks for is the simplest way, the most economical, optimal way to structure this new system. It's what Einstein once called the miracle creed. Said it's a belief, but it's a belief so well substantiated by the history of science that we just take it for granted, no matter what the skeptic may say. Nature looks for the simplest way. That was Galileo's precept at the origins of modern science, since been refined substantially and become just the norm for scientific inquiry. And makes
sense. Can I put in a proviso? The simplest way, provided you can get from here to there, given
that's
the system.
Right. The simplest way that nature can
accomplish.
There might be physically impossible ways.
Absolutely. Yes.
So, yes, the second stage is nature constructs the simplest system that is biologically possible. Then comes the third stage. It's called winnowing, you can call it. It's a stage where those organisms that reproduce more effectively tend to stick around. That's natural selection. It's the third stage. It certainly has major effects. After the Cambrian explosion 500 billion years ago, natural selection led to a huge variety of organisms, all determined by the basic step that nature took when it created the simplest possible form. Now, of course, that happens over and over. So in the course of evolution, you keep going through these three stages. Notice that at each stage, what nature constructs may be dysfunctional for use. Nature has no information about how this is going to be used. It's just a physical system that constructs the simplest possible thing, as it does for atoms or anything else.
Well, it could be really accidental, like an asteroid hitting the planet and changing the environment so much that what might have been adaptive in one environment is totally different.
Correct. And if this happens over and over innumerable times, the end result, though it may have been the best possible choice at each point, can be highly dysfunctional, because none of these steps have any information about what's going to come. So the human beings are a perfect example. The physical structure of humans happens to be highly dysfunctional in many ways. The spine is badly engineered for large bipedal mammals. There's many other things that are
crossing over of speech and swallowing.
Lots of things, I mean, in another dimension, the fact that we have 10 fingers rather than 8 is highly dysfunctional. If we had 8
or 12,
fingers,
12 would be nice too.
Well, 8 would be better because it's gives you a natural base for computation. We were stuck with base 10, which is a nuisance. If we had base 8, everything would be a lot easier. But nature had no way to think of the fact that we were going to use computers someday. Well, that's the way evolution works. Take a look at language. I think it works pretty much the same way.
Well, yeah, I'd like to expand on that. Because I've always found this striking sort of parallel. You mentioned the Cambrian Revolution, but if there was a long period of human evolution in which vocabularies were very limited and mostly things happened with single word utterances, we know gorillas and other primates have this repertory of vocalizations which have particular effects on other members of their troops. It seems to me that at the moment at which we reach the point of combining words, which is the only point at which grammar can emerge, we suddenly have the possibility of multi-word utterances, which are to single-word utterances as multi-celled organisms are to single-celled organisms. And you then have an explosion of diversity that becomes possible once that happens. And I see that happening in language as being something analogous to the Cambrian Revolution happening to organisms. In both cases, it also mattered that the cells were not only just increasing in number, because they were organisms before that, in which they all had the same functions, but their functions become differentiated, just like parts of speech become differentiated once you have grammar. So the explosion of language may have some things in common with the explosion of diversity in species.
Well, I look a little bit differently. Well, here's the facts come in. Apes don't even have single words. They don't have anything like words. In fact, the experiments with laboriously trying to teach apes something similar to language could never even get the concept of a word across. The main experimental work was with NIM, Herb Terrace's program.
Well, yeah, but Herb, by the way, I know Herb very well because he and I were contemporaries as graduate students. And we used to argue all the time about those sorts of things, but he really disadvantaged NIM because he had, I think the first thing you might want to ask the ape was, can you show that kind of structure if the humans who are giving you these samples that you're supposed to copy are doing it in a consistent way? And he had different students doing it. Each of the students had different standards. NIM would be like a human infant who was just had a very brief time with speakers of lots of different languages and never any extended time with any one of them. And it may well be that his conclusion is right, but that's the way that experiment was conducted
Laura Petito was the main experimentalist. She spent endless time with NIM. She was the one who,
later when all of this
not after the first few, but early on, she took over, spent endless time with him. They thought that they were getting, actually Herb Terrace, I don't think had much to do with it. It was in the hands of the experimenters all the time. And they thought that they were getting results, but when they reviewed, did a frame by frame reanalysis of the videos, they found that it was nothing, that NIM was making random signs. And
it's a little bit more complicated than that, but I think that there have been, in any case, studies that are have come to different conclusions. Dave Premax, for example, Dave didn't worry about gestures,
Dave Premack ended up recognizing that you can get nothing language-like out of Sarah. So he started doing something much more sensible. He began investigating Sarah's own cognitive capacities, not trying to impose on the chimp something that's outside of its cognitive capacities. And then he did interesting works on Sarah's actual cognitive capacities, but nothing remotely language-like.
Well, but if the point is, were there units of some sort that were established by those kinds of procedures? I think there were, and I'm really not too worried about whether we call them words or something else. It seems we somewhere along the line, we develop units that are bigger, and I certainly am with you on the notion that we humans do something special with recursion and the way these units develop. But
no, the units themselves are radically different. Then comes another step, namely the leap to unboundedness. Now that has to be a single step. There's no way to learn that the numbers go on forever. You can't get to 83 and say, I'm a little closer. It's a one-step move that goes from one to infinity. You can't go part way.
So yes,
but you have to have units like 1, 2, 3, and 4 to get to that.
You can go to 2, 3, 4, 83, and 156, and you're exactly where you are when you had 1. Okay,
but so you have to have those, and you have to somehow
get the concept that it's unbounded, and that's in one step, just by logic. So yes, there was a great leap forward. But it was the move, there were several, but one was finding the units which are unique to humans. The most elementary meaning-bearing humans, units have no analog in the animal world. Then comes the next step, infinity, which has to be one step. And that was some kind of change in the wiring of the brain, which suddenly gave unboundedness. Well, when you have these two things, then you have at least the rudiments of language, but no other organism has either of them. And there's no reason, and I don't think it has anything to do with speech, because it works just as well with sign.
Sure it does.
It has.
But I'm actually delighted that one of the things I had hoped we would talk about was units. And maybe we're talking about units of things at different levels, but units is one of the things that I've been worrying about throughout my career. I've always been fascinated by, you know, Hebb's cells that fire together, wire together, and those sorts of things. But I've been much more concerned as time's gone on what creates the boundaries between units. And maybe this is getting to the point that's well before we'd ever talk about anything like a word. I had mentioned in our first discussion some work on what happens in the cortex where you have boundaries. And so we have these homunculi that, so for example, in the human cortex, there are regions that correspond to the fingers. And it turns out that there are chemical differences in the boundaries between the fingers. And the only thing that I see that makes sense of that is that if you're stimulating the fingers, then cells that are next to each other are almost always going to be simultaneously stimulated when you touch. But if you're talking about the one side of this finger and the facing side of the adjacent finger, they will sometimes be stimulated simultaneously, but sometimes separately. And that seems to actually create an anatomical boundary. I wonder whether things like categorical perception of phonemes, in which you go from, at least in English, from the B to the P, and you actually have a sharp boundary, so nobody ever hears something that's in between, unless you were raised in Arabic, and then you hear the one that's in between because that's the phoneme that you've learned in Arabic, and that boundary never got created. I have the suspicion that there's something there that tells us about how things begin to hang together as units. And for me, it gets on to things that almost include a kind of a recursion within the kinds of classes of units. I'll try to make this as quick as I can, but just to switch to a different kind of issue. We're talking about some child who's got some really serious behavioral difficulties. This child is diagnosed with self-injurious behavior, and the kid does things like bites his arm to the point of drawing blood or is banging his head against the wall. And the folks who see this problem want to deal with it, and they think about things like, well, do the parents pay attention to this kid differentially when the kid's doing this as opposed to other things? And they just never get anywhere with it. And what we later discover is that what holds the different classes of behavior together is that they have common effects. And what you have to do is, this kid also gets attention from other people by shouting obscenities or by picking on other kids or by breaking things. And so you have to look at all that attention getting behavior as being a member of the common class. That's the unit. And you do much better at getting rid of the self-injurious stuff if you deal with all of the other things that have the same effects. Now, if that's the larger class, and then there's another class we call self-injurious behavior that's part of that. And then within that class, there's the banging your head versus biting yourself. And within those classes, there are all the little bits and pieces that can go together to make them up. That's a sort of an embedded series of bigger and bigger units. And it is, to me, there's almost, it's not recursion in the same sense that you talk about it with respect to language, but it is a kind of a thing that's there in which some units are embedded in other units that I think is worth looking at. So I sort of offer that as a way of also thinking about things within language, because there too, we have letters, words, sentences, paragraphs, chapters, books, and so on.
Well, we do.
I've probably gone on too long. Sorry, but.
I think that's a fascinating topic about how hierarchic structures are developed in different ways. And in fact, other animals do that too. But it's not clear that that has, I mean, has a kind of a superficial similarity to, you know, sounds, words, and so on. But it doesn't seem to, as far as I can see, it doesn't lead to any way of explaining the particular form in which this takes. I mean, what happens, there is a lot known by now about how infants do categorize and organize the world, as you know very well, but including the noises that they hear around them. So a newborn infant, instantly, as soon as it can be tested by nipple sucking and surprise reactions, it can tell it's the language of its mother from a different language, both spoken by a bilingual woman whose voice it's never heard. And by now there's some understanding of the features that the baby is looking for, in fact, even intrauterine, apparently, because it's instantaneous on birth. Mostly prosodic structures seem to be analyzed. Languages that have similar prosodic structures that don't arouse the surprise reaction in the infant. If they have different prosodic structures, they do. So that seems to be the first thing that infants are kind of looking for, identifying a prosodic structure. Then that already begins to break down the noises into some kinds of units, because prosodic structures do have, you know, they don't have explicit breaks, but they go up and down and so on and so forth. And that seems to be the break that gives the first units. Then very quickly, by about 9 or 10 months, the infants have developed the categorical perception that you just mentioned.
Yeah, I think I'd say sooner than that.
Really, I think it's about 10 months, but you could look anyhow.
I mean, I think some of them are there earlier on. The nipple sucking studies are showing things like the distinction between P's and B's, I think in a matter of weeks, if I recall that literature.
But so I think it's maybe, I think you get the basic phonetics of the language by about 9 or 10 months old. Maybe there are earlier steps, but so by 10 months old, a Japanese infant is not distinguishing what we hear as R and L, for example.
Yeah.
We're not, in English-speaking infants are not distinguishing the Arabic emphatic consonants from the regular consonants. And then goes on another regular series of steps in which you get the basic concepts, the linguistic expression of them, which could be a sign or a sound. And then by 2 or 3 years, as far as we know, that basically the fundamental structure of language is there. After that, it's a matter of further refinements. There are some things that come in near puberty. So if you look at it, it's things like more complex structures. John promised Bill to leave. It means John's leaving, not Bill's leaving. that those distinctions don't seem to come in until about 9 or 10 years old. And for many people, they never come at all. So that seems to be acquisition of a later principle, a principle that's more superficial.
Some of these are such that the later ones seem to be really dependent on mastering the earlier ones first. I guess my recollection, it's been a while since I've looked at that literature, is that the infant goes through a progression from intonation patterns to vowels, and then the simple consonants come in first. Right. And I remember when I was starting to look at that literature really early on, the story was that the child starts out speaking all the sounds of all the possible human languages, but right. That seemed not to be the case. That you get these changes of first vowels and simple things, and then they come up with the more complex articulations that become the consonants and so on.
It has to be the case that at the beginning, the child uses everything because has no idea what the language is going to be. But then systematically, you get categorization. It's pretty much fixed for phonetics by maybe 9 or 10 months. Actually, there's a very good review of this by Liz Spelke in her recent book, What Babies Know, which surveys most of the literature on this and vision. Yeah. And other categories.
A little early in that, one I was familiar with was, I think, Veman, who wrote a book on the evolution of phonetics in infants. But somehow the units get created and they separate out from each other, and that still is part of what. Maybe it's inevitable that they have to break down into separate bits. One of our problems in general in the world, and in a totally different context, I'm dealing with issues about racial discrimination, gender discrimination, that sort of thing, and it seems everywhere you look, there we have these continua, whether it's the color of one's skin or the continuum from male to female, because there's all the variations in between depending upon anatomy and hormones and so forth. And we humans can't deal with that except by coming up with words, and words necessarily cut things up into categories. And pretty soon we're categorizing people and things. And it seems to me almost an inevitable problem created by language that we go from continua and we start dealing with dichotomies or trichotomies, whatever, instead.
I think it's probably deeper than language. I think it happens in other dimensions as well. You just have to categorize experience, or else you're lost. You can't deal with a world in a continuous flux. So you have to break it up somehow. I think this is the same for other organisms. The language thing just goes on its own very specific way, has very definite properties. And it seems to be a common human affair. Doesn't seem to be any differences in different tribes or groups. Probably was all in place not long after the appearance of modern humans. As I said before, we do have genomic evidence now about separation of human groups not too long after appearance of modern humans, and there don't seem to be differences in cognitive or linguistic capacities. So presumably it was all in place and doesn't ever seem to have changed. There's no indication of any meaningful evolutionary change in the nature of articulatory organs, certainly not of gestures, all fixed long before language appeared, and doesn't seem to be affected by it. But this is the superficial side.
Us use our hands more than others.
Yeah, that's right. But that's cultural.
I know.
So there are languages where you're gesturing all the time. But I had in mind sign language. Notice it's very interesting work showing that for infants, the gestural system and for sign and the gestural system for life are dissociated. I don't know if you know about Laura Petito's work with a young infant son. Well, what she showed is that the state, there's a stage, I think maybe 15 months old or something like that, where speaking children, infants, tend to interchange first and second pronoun. So they refer to themselves as you and to their mother as I, naturally, because that's what they hear. Well, it turns out that signing infants do the same thing. But that's quite striking because they're using the same gesture to, when they use the gesture to point, they do it, they point to their mother for this way. But when they're using the gesture to speak, they point this way for their mother. That's they're doing the same thing that speaking children are doing, but with the same gesture, which is pretty dramatic. And of course, then they follow the normal pattern later on when it recovers. But, so there seems to be a real dissociation between the language, even the language gestures, and the gestures for ordinary interpersonal activity and behavior, which is another more indication that the language system is just going off on its own. It's not part of the general system of interaction and behavior.
The sounds don't have directionality to them the way a gesture does. So that's part of it, I guess. I seem to recall a paper about a child who simply never mastered the first, second person pronoun distinction. And but it's long enough ago that I don't remember the details, but it's those cases in which something's missing that lead one to worry about which kinds of things can be separated out from the rest of the system. I find it interesting that you're talking about the ways in which language then sort of becomes insulated from other things and becomes its own self-contained system. I mentioned to you earlier that we've done this research in which we, instead of trying to tell people how to do things, we wait until they say things, and we try to, without even telling them they're right or wrong, just by giving them simple kinds of feedback, shape up what they're saying about a task. And we'd have some things in which they were involved with simple tasks like pressing a button. And humans will typically be totally insensitive to the contingencies that would lead any other creature in the world to go fast if the payoff depends on number, and slow if the payoff depends on time. But we could get them to respond fast or slow if we got them to say, the way this works is you press it fast, and the way this works is you press it slow. And when we were learning how to do that experiment, we get some people who would end up saying, well, you do three fast and two slow. And then the next time they'd be trying, well, one slow and two fast. And they were going through all the possible permutations of numbers, and we can never get them out of that. It's as if they got into this verbal trap. And we began to sort of just talking about this, and maybe some of the kinds of things that we call religious verbal systems are verbal traps of that sort. They no longer have any connection to anything outside the verbal system. And
is it a verbal system or a conceptual system?
Well,
or can you distinguish?
Sure. I mean, you could call it either one. But for me, the important feature of it is you can push it around with the way you respond to them. And if you ask them what was going on, they will give you some reason, and then they won't say, you got me to say it, even though that's what really happened. We did get them to say it. They'll say, I finally figured it out. You told me I was right. And so part of what's important there is that they see it as something that they initiated rather than something that came from the outside. And for us, and especially in the context of what we talked about last time with respect to freedom and all, it seems to be, I'd say it's really important that people recognize where the source of the change was. If we are, in fact, getting somebody to say something different and they don't see that we were the ones who did it and they didn't initiate themselves, they are at a disadvantage. And I think that happens too much in our world today, that politicians and others get people to do things by reacting. It's a problem. But I don't have a solution. Like,
I don't know if this is relevant, but it sounds a little bit like Dick Held's early work on reafferent stimulation, where if the individual initiates the action, you perceive it. If it happens, the same action happens from the outside, you don't perceive it. Like if you move your finger and something happens, you perceive it. If someone else moves your finger, you don't see it. At the very elementary level. Yeah, so it seems like initiating action is critical for even elementary perception.
Well, yeah, but the thing is that people are often pretty good at identifying things that make things happen with respect to non-language things they do. They tend to be less likely to recognize the things that influence what they say. And so I think that there's something important there that we ought that people ought to know more about, which is one of the things I've been trying to write about, is the sources of the things that change the kinds of things we say, which of course for me as a person who comes out of behavior analysis, I'm looking at the environment for the sources, and we humans are each other's environments. So I'm looking there. I'm looking at our host, by the way, who suggested that we might worry about the timing of things. I can still think of other topics that we might want to address, but do you think it's too soon to think about just making some closing remarks, or would you like to move on to?
I think we're doing fine. Let's talk about this. I mean, I'm interested in the possible connection. I don't know if it's real, between things like reafferent stimulation and initiation of more complex behaviors of the kind you're talking about. Could there be a connection, or is it too remote?
Well, I think this is the topic here is about one's judgments about one's own behavior. Most of us sort of take it for granted that we know what we're doing, but then again, sometimes we'll find that we did something without having noticed it. And so I see that as a place where, if I were going to the lab and wanted to study that, I'd look at what people were doing. I'd have them answer questions about what they were doing and try to find out where they were accurate in their descriptions and where they were inaccurate. But I would then take another step that I think is not usually taken. So, for example, let me do an analogy first. In developmental psychology, very often there'll be a description of a sort of natural progression. So children have to be able to say they remember before they learn the word forget, typically. Hellman and a few other developmentalists have gone through that progression of that kind of vocabulary. And saying I never knew is different from saying I knew it, but then I forgot it. And there's a definitely a developmental progression in which children tend to do this at a certain age, and they tend to do this other one later. And I may be wrong in the details, but there are some people who've looked at developmental things who actually ask the question, well, what if we tried to teach it to a child? Now, if you were Piagetian, you'd say you don't have to and you shouldn't even bother because it's just going to develop as a matter of course. But if you come from my kind of orientation, you'd say, well, maybe there are natural contingencies that shape it up. Maybe there are also structural issues that require these to be learned in a certain order. And so let's try to teach it and see what we run into. Taking that point, if we got to the situation of looking at people doing things and describing them well or describing them poorly, or not even be able to recognize that they had done something, I would want to explore ways in which you try to teach it in different ways. Just as you could say, teach somebody who might be going to visit a physician to learn things about what you might be worrying about, feeling, should you be in threat of a cardiac event or something like that. You can teach these things. Maybe we just learn these things accidentally in environments that are more likely to produce attention to that in some areas than others. If you're going into dance or theater or something, you learn to make judgments about your own behavior and you get sharper and sharper at doing it. And if you're not very good at that, you won't go on in that as a career. But maybe everybody has the capacity to learn much more detail about this. And I don't know how I'd tie it to the reaffirmation and that work, but I think it's an experimentally accessible area.
Well, this seems to relate very closely to a longstanding issue going back centuries about educational psychology. Mm-hmm. In teaching, do you impose something on the student? The analogy back in the 18th century was, do you pour water into a vessel? Versus the alternative that said, treat a child like a flower. It has to grow in its own way and you can water it. You can provide the conditions under which the child will grow and flourish in its own way. And what you discover for yourself stays. What's imposed on you, you don't stay. It doesn't stay.
Oh, that fits beautifully. Yeah. My way of thinking about things in education is developed in conjunction with Elliot Chimoff, a late colleague of mine with whom I did a lot of team teaching. And we came to the conclusion that what the student learns is what the student does. And it hardly mattered what we did. We could get them to take online quizzes. We can get them to take quizzes in class. We can do things to make them more likely to read the textbook. We can get them more likely to attend classes and just be there. Anything we did that got the students to do more with respect to the subject matter increased what the students learned. And so the business of, yes, pouring knowledge into the...
Period, that's Bertrand Russell and John Dewey teach to text, train for tests. You know, it's
just that. Have them read more, have them do things on their own, because the tendency is if you can't teach the standard math, well then let's try teaching the new math instead. Let's change what we teach instead of finding a way to do the teaching of this thing better. And I think we do have techniques that are effective, but it's very, very hard to impact the educational system, of course.
I'll tell you an anecdote about new math which bears on this. I was actually involved slightly back around 1960 when the new math ideas came along. A lot of hotshot mathematicians sort of asked, what do we want a student to know when they come into college? Let's divide it into 12, you know? And they were teaching, instead of addition and multiplication, you were teaching set theory, Boolean algebra, and so on. My daughter was in a fourth grade, I think, at the time, and her teacher was trying to teach division and using new math with Boolean algebra. And the teacher didn't understand it at all. So she was reading out of the textbook and saying, well, you do this and you do that. And the kids didn't know what the hell was going on, but they sort of figured out some way to do it. A friend of mine who was a logician, an Israeli logician, came to visit. And he had been trying to teach junior high school students, Boolean algebra and elementary set theory and so on, getting nowhere. So he started asking my daughter, fourth grade kid, how do you, when you have sets, he asked various questions about sets. And she said, then he asked, what's the null set? Which set is in every other set? And she said, the null set. And he was very surprised. And then I asked her, how do you know that the null set is in every other set? And she said, well, if you look at the sets, there's a little space between them, and that's where the null set is. She had made up a kind of a visual image that made sense out of all this nonsense that was being sent to her. But of course, the kids all learned long division at home because they weren't learning anything at school.
Yeah, when I was a senior, I took a seminar in teaching with Fred Keller, and we all had to do a project. And I had a younger brother, 13 years younger than me, and at that time he was 8 years old. And so I took on as the project teaching him the distributive law. And the way I did it was to teach him a little bit about unknowns in algebra. I taught his spelling the law out, writing it out. I found six or seven different ways of teaching it. And I ended up writing that up as my project and was reasonably successful. I must say that later on, he got into accounting and eventually he didn't get a CPA or anything like that, but he ended up working and writing the computer programs for salaries and that sort of thing. And he went into doing that kind of job in a businesses. And so the feedback I got was that getting the early start and just learning how to handle unknowns, learning to do each of these simple things was good enough. But I think the key to it was not saying it's just going to be this one thing, but you tackle this in every different possible way you can deal with it. And by the time you finish that, that's what it really means to understand the distributive law in mathematics. So the thing I'm delighted about all of this is that here I'm coming at these discussions as a person who's trained as a behavior analyst. Mm-hmm. And I'm pleased that we have these kinds of things to talk about. I did see your editorial on ChatGPT, and I was inclined to try to quickly write an op-ed piece talking about how the behaviorists and the linguists agree on this thing, because I'm thoroughly in agreement with you that ChatGPT does not think like humans.
So, gentlemen, I'm sorry to interrupt, gentlemen, but into another very interesting topic, I need you to know that.
But I have to go off right now, I'm afraid.
Do you perhaps have time now on for 2 minutes on those sort of wrap up to sort of wrap up your position on language?
Just one brief comment, then I'll have to leave. I think the important thing that comes out of this discussion is that the way a child grows and develops, or the way an adult behaves, basically has to come from the inside. You can set conditions under which there will be flourishing or diminution of abilities, but it's going to have to be self-generated. That's the way growth and development and intelligent action take place. And I'm afraid with that, I'll just have to leave.
Okay, and I would just close by saying that the child has to live in an interesting environment for interesting things to happen. Because if there's no environment, there's not much we're going to see. And at some point, both of us are looking at similar things from very different perspectives, but we're looking at the same underlying subject matter. Thank you for the opportunity to have
you talk to you again.
Gracias por ver este vídeo. Os dejamos por aquí un enlace a nuestra última formación y por aquí algunos vídeos que os pueden resultar de interés. Si estáis buscando ayuda psicológica, también podéis mirar en la descripción del vídeo, donde encontraréis nuestra web y podréis solicitar asistencia terapéutica de un profesional confiable y que os ofrecerá ayuda psicológica basada en evidencia científica.